That's our roll call. Approval of the minutes from the previous meeting. Everyone receive a copy of the minutes? If so, and if you read them, can I get a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Grady, seconded by Supervisor Zelinski to approve the minutes from the previous meeting. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor, you the governor?
Aye.
Committee?
Aye.
Move on to chairman, committee member, supervisor, the government comments. We have naturally, through our reports here this evening, you'll hear what everybody's doing with dolphin parks and things, and I'm sure that you've all seen the reports and heard about the Emerald Ash Borer removal. And Matt and John will report on that, but because of the oddity or not oddity for Wisconsin winter of this year, we're behind schedule on that. It's not a huge factor in the long term. We have plans in place. That's one of the biggest things going on right now as far as the Parks Department and highways and everything. Everybody's enjoying a pretty good winter, so that's all I have. Any committee members have anything? If not, we'll move on. Citizens' comments. Any citizens that would like to address the committee on any matter? We have 5 minutes to speak. We just ask that you give your name and address. Any citizens' comments? Then we'll move on to division reports. And first this evening is Parks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you noted previously, Emerald Ash Borer, we have the tree removal currently going underway over at Petrified Springs Park. We have approximately 2,000 trees that have already been removed, and the park is currently closed down to the general public. The last we heard, it's noted on this report that we hope to and anticipate to open on Wednesday. The last we heard as of today that that'll be pushed back until Friday, so we're hoping by Friday that that'll be back open again. And we're kind of, you know, just depending on the weather to cooperate as much as possible from here on out. After we're done with Petrified Springs, we're going to move along to Fox River Park. Bruntendale Golf Course, and then finally Fox River Park. Our county staff is in charge of removing ash trees at Silver Lake, Crystal Woods, and Old Settlers, which we're majority already completed with our own staff. Then moving on to the Kemper storm damage, extensive storm damage occurred back in December. We did meet with Bear and Marine Specialists, and we're looking for short and long-term fixes for that seawall over there. Unfortunately, insurance will not cover that damage. So hopefully we hear back from those specialists that we can actually look over the plans to see what we can do to fix that seawall, more of a permanent fix. For the Petrified Springs Veterans Memorial, we did receive a letter back from Congressman Paul Ryan's office. So we're moving forward with that. All we have to do is wait for the local legion to complete formal paperwork on some past ceremonial rifles that have been issued to their legion. So as soon as we get that paperwork completed through the legion, we should be moving forward with that cannon. Then next is the Petrified Springs, the Bugman demolition. We're still on for mid-February to get that burned down, so we should be still on schedule for that one. And then finally, last but not least, we're looking into the feasibility to introduce foot golf into Kenosha County, so we hope to report more details on that in future months. And that's all I have.
Thank you, Matt. Anybody have any questions for Matt? Anything?
I missed the one. Bill? When is scheduled to be burned?
The Bogman, it's called. It's over at Petrified Springs in our service yard area.
Okay, so it's not one of the properties on Green Bay Road. It's actually internal to the park.
It's internal to the park, correct.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jenna. We will move on to Bill.
Included in your packet was our 2016 golf rates and our season pass rates to provide value for our county residents and others. We are suggesting that we do not increase our rates, that we've had the same rates since 2010. So we need to inform you guys that see if you'd like to change the rates at all.
Any questions or discussion on the golf rates?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
And how are they in general against the private sector, your competition? How do we fare?
We're right about average. I mean, there are golf courses, and you know, these are all the established published rates, and there's a lot of discounting that goes on in golf, but we're underneath, you know, quite a few golf courses around here, you know, it all depends on, you know, what the market's driven to drive the specials. You know, everything west of us is obviously a lot more expensive in Lake Geneva area, but in this area we're real competitive.
I mean, it depends on the course. I mean, I don't compare you guys to Big Oaks as an example, right?
Right.
You're certainly above that, but so you're pretty comfortable with our position and not necessarily excessively low.
Pardon me?
In your opinion, we're not excessively low.
No, we are. I don't believe that we're excessively low. I mean, one of the things that we always have to be concerned with is we have 63 holes of golf, and we have to be able to fill them, and, you know, that's why we offer the rates that we do.
And based on, and I understand every year is weather dependent, we can maintain ourselves in the black with these rates?
Correct, yes.
Give or take, I'm not trying to hold you to it, I understand. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Many times before, you've spoken how you wish Petrified Springs and Brightondale would actually switch number of holes. And right now, Petrified Springs is $2 cheaper than Brightondale. Why? Because Brightondale's further west? Because I'm figuring that Petrified Springs is pretty busy all the time.
A lot of our business has shifted to the west, you know, Brightondale, they both fit different clientele. Petrifying Springs is a shorter golf course. It's 6,000 square feet, or 6,000 yards long. The greens are a lot smaller. They're all elevated, so it provides a different challenge. Brightondale has a more championship feel. You know, more of your championship golf courses are longer. We have the White Birch, which is 7,000 yards over there. Brightondale is kind of becoming its own destination golf course. You know, people have to drive to get there. They anticipate a full day of golf. There's a lot more 9-hole rounds at Petrifying Springs, a lot more 18-hole rounds at Brightondale. So we feel to try and fill both facilities that these are the rates that really work for the golf courses.
Dan can't say it. He has to be a little more cautious, but we can say that the older guys that have been used to, they're cheaper. That's, you know, you have the guys that travel and the groups that come from out of state and things, and they're used to spend a little more money. But we have to keep pets for the local, kind of what they're used to consuming. So this doesn't go to the county board at all. This is this committee. But I would like to have a motion from the committee to approve these rates. Moved by Supervisor Frederick to approve the rates for the 2016 season.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Poole. Any discussion? If not, use the governance.
Aye.
Committee?
Aye.
So,
thank you.
You're good to go, then.
We put the finalization to the 2016 business plan with your approval of our rates, so thank you very much. We have a lot of incentives and initiatives in there that we're going to try and continue with our run of profitability here. You know, we're right now, we have our database up to 19,000 people with going to the golf show. We're going to Chicago February 26th and 28th through the 28th, and then we're going to go to Milwaukee March 11th through the 13th. With that, we'll have over 20,000 people, 21,000 people probably in our database, and really moves the needle. I mean, when we send out an email blast, you know, things happen. So it's really great having that kind of resource for us. We're also working on rebooking all of our past leagues and outings. We have had several league inquiries. You know, Petrifying Springs is pretty packed from 3:30 to 5:30 weekdays, so we're trying to move some more leagues out to Brightondale. The men's club that we got started a couple years ago really took off last year, really grew to about 48 players. This year our goal is to move it to 64 players or more. Really, every single Wednesday last year was a great day for us, just because we had, you know, that little bit of compression, and has helped us out a great deal. So that's great. Really having a productive off season. I want to say thank you to facilities. We have Tim Catt over at Petrifying Springs doing a deep cleaning on the building. It's never looked that good. I mean, he's doing a phenomenal job. Mike Woodward is helping out with changing out our lighting over from CFLs to LEDs. Phenomenal change. I mean, it really, really has just sparked up, you know, how that building looks. I think the people that come, the guests, are really going to enjoy, you know, the new look to Petrifying Springs. We're also getting some new countertops in our concession area, put some new vanities and sinks in our bathrooms, so you know, it's going to provide even a better experience than people have been going through, so it's really good. Emerald Ash project, you know, it's my understanding that they are going to try and have Petrifying Springs golf course for sure done this week. You know, they're going to try and have the park done too, but it's amazing what you see out there with this project and how many trees that they're taking down. The Deep Well project, we're putting together the RFP for that project. We are going to have to go out for bid with that. They're going to have to reinstall 550 feet of pipe and one of two different kinds of pumps, so we'll be going out with that shortly. The Blue Spruce Irrigation Project, that was won by Midwest Irrigation. The bid came in about $100,000 less than what we had budgeted, which was just really great. I mean, they knew that there was a lot of competition. There were six vendors actually that showed up for the pre-bid meeting, and it was a nice big project. So as we budgeted, instead of breaking it apart, it really helped us out with the economy of scale by getting that low bid. So things are a lot of things going on, a lot of things moving, but it's really exciting now in golf.
Just to comment on the carts, where are we with the life cycle of the golf carts that we own and replacement and that type of thing?
The last third of the fleet that was up for purchase has been purchased for Petrifying Springs. We're going to have 65 new golf cars. We purchased the EasyGo golf cars off a national bid, and they will be being delivered this spring to Petrifying Springs golf course. So then all of them have been replaced in 14, 15, and 16.
Okay. So we're up to speed on that basically.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Anything else? All right, we'll move on to facilities for Mike.
All right, to start with the energy team project status list. I think you'll have copies. Changes are in red as always. The top column is the ongoing projects. There's only one change there. It's a project at the safety building for a deramping system for the ice control. That one has just started Monday, and it's probably going to take about a month to get done. To the bottom are the completed projects. I moved two down from the top list. One is the replacement of the boilers at KCAB. That's done now. And at Brookside, we replaced three hot water heaters, and that's squared away too. It's the energy team ones. Next up, I've got an informational letter to transfer funds from one completed project to another. The original project was a $65,000 budgeted project that we approved last year. We actually spent $32,000 of it, and we're requesting that the extra funds be moved to another almost emergency type project to replace three hot water heaters in the same facility at the retrial. There are three 100-gallon hot water heaters. One has got a leak in it, so it's got to be replaced no matter what. and that's about $10,000 alone just for the one. And the life of them is pretty much over. They're 19 years old, so we kind of said, well, maybe we should look at doing all three at the same time. And we got a quote for that, and they came in at $8,000 apiece instead of $10,000 each. So with those funds left over from the added cell project, we were thinking that maybe we could go ahead and do that project. So that's what that informational letter is for. Moving on beyond that, with other projects, there's just one on the list for the public safety building. We're replacing the fire panel there. That work has officially started Monday. It's moving along nice already.
Any questions on any of these? Thank you, Mike. We'll move on to Frank. Roger.
Chairman, KCC Highway Garage Roof Replacement. We've got the specs out on the street, and we have the bid walkthrough scheduled for February 16th, and we have the bids due March 3rd. As far as the fire alarm system replacement, we're finishing up the specs for the courthouse. The courthouse is by far the biggest, most involved. The specifications now require not just a horn, but in that kind of building, speakers. So, and all of the smoke alarms, everything like that has to be replaced. So that's going to be a year-long project, but we're finishing up the specs this week. We expect to get the bid out next week. With that, we're using the same electrical engineer, David Hansen, and with getting those specs wrapped up for the courthouse fire alarm system, we're going to be going to the PSB generator replacement, which is original to the building, very early 80s, and they can't get replacement parts for it anymore. So we're actually going to be meeting Wednesday with our maintenance people down there and start specking out that new generator.
So that's the one that ran when the power went out, but then we went to test it a week later, it wouldn't start. Yeah.
Yep, that's it. There was the two, both of them kicked on, but that's the one that a week later when we did the test, it
worked when it needed to.
Yeah,
it
did.
But I remember you were, it's all been reported, the committee remembers, but no, discussed this, and it's
that's
all
exactly
budgeted, right?
Exactly the case, and they put the money in for this year's budget.
Yeah.
So.
Any questions for Frank on any of these items? Thank you, Frank. Didn't take that long, Gary. We were there.
Sounds good.
The resolution before you, I would consider it a bit of a housekeeping matter. The Village of Pleasant Prairie has modified their land use plans in the vicinity of 39th Avenue and Springbrook Road. There's been some pretty extensive changes, and as part of those changes, we've vacated roads, discontinued roads, some sections of Highway ML and EZ have been jurisdictionally transferred. In fact, we just did one of those recently. And the Village of Pleasant Prairie, based on their final land use plan, has been developing certified survey maps of that entire area. And in the course of doing that, they discovered that a section of Springbrook Court, which back in 1994 was a part of County Trunk Highway ML, was never transferred to the village. When we did that project back in 1994, we relocated Highway ML, and since that time, the village has been maintaining this little segment of Springbrook Court, but neither the village or the county ever realized that the Wisconsin Department of Transportation never certified that mileage as a village road. So basically, since that time, the village has been maintaining it. but they've not been receiving the transportation aids to do that. What this resolution will do is to jurisdictionally transfer a 300-foot long segment of Springbrook Court from the county to the village. It basically has no financial impact on the county since our transportation aids are based on actual cost, but it does affect the village because their transportation aids are based on mileage. So by adding that mileage to them, it does increase their transportation aids, which is appropriate since they've been maintaining it all these years, and they certainly accept responsibility for maintaining it in the future. So it's a little 300-foot long section of Springbrook Court. It serves two residential properties, and I would recommend that the resolution be approved.
Motion to approve the resolution is submitted.
No. Moved by Supervisor Gillespie, seconded by Supervisor Frederick to approve. Any discussion? You the governor?
Aye.
Committee?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. A couple of things in reports. Back to the ash trees. We are also addressing some areas of ash trees. Right now we're working along Highway A by Petrifying Springs Park, since the park is closed and it's pretty much a low traffic volume time. We thought it was a good time to get in there and remove all those ash trees. It's actually one of the highest concentration of ash trees that we have along county trunk highways. We have had a couple inquiries outside of that area about removing ash trees, and it's not a straightforward, simple process to determine responsibility to remove trees on highways. We actually don't have the authority to remove trees along the majority of our highways, because the majority of our highways are easements, and those trees actually belong to the adjacent property owners. So we can remove them for highway purposes, but we can't just go and start cutting down trees for any other reason. So what I'm going to do is develop a policy or more of a procedure that we follow as we get these inquiries of dead ash trees along county trunk highways, and then I'll come back with that procedure and present it to the committee, and we'll move forward with that. I don't think it's a huge problem on county trunk highways. It's my understanding that many ash, if not most ash trees, were actually planted, that they're really not a widespread native tree. So unless somebody planted them, there probably aren't that many that were just established on their own. So long story short, I'll come back with a procedure that I will recommend that we follow for that, for the rest of the ash tree removals on county trunk highways.
I'm sure you already thought about this with your attorney as well, have some type of ideas and thoughts on if people have a dead ash that's going to affect the roadway at some point, and they do nothing. Okay. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of dead ones that could be a safety issue to the highway,
right,
eventually. And what our procedure would be if that tree sits there for 8 years.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's my understanding they get very brittle, and
it's about 8 years.
It doesn't take much for them to become a hazard. I will absolutely include that. Last week we had the Highway S public informational meeting for the reconstruction between Highway H and 31 that meeting was held at the Village of Summers and incredibly well attended. We had over 50 people that signed in, and I would say there was at least double that actually attending. Pretty much comments from one extreme to the other, everything from people, I mean, it's an expansion project, so, you know, it's going from two lanes to four lanes and has a tremendous impact on the adjacent property owners. So a lot of interest, and, you know, some people were hoping to be bought out by the county and relocated. Some people would prefer to stay, you know, and everything in between. It was just an introductory meeting at this point. We went there with 9 different alternatives that impacted everybody in a little bit different fashion. Had a lot of good comments from the residents, and a lot of people that didn't live along or even in the area of the road of the project that were just interested in seeing what was going on because they travel on the road, and it's gets to be quite frustrating at times because of the volumes and the inability of that two-lane road to handle that traffic. So it highly successful. We will be taking all those comments, looking at the project itself, and I would say by I'm hoping by maybe June we'll have a recommended design of those 9 alternatives. We will have choose one to present to the public again sometime this summer. So there'll be at least one more public informational meeting, probably 2, and otherwise the project's moving forward very nicely. So we got a couple other public informational meetings coming up on multi-use path projects, 2 of them being in the town of Summers, one on Highway E and another along Highway 31 from Pets up north to Highway KR. That public informational meeting will be on February 18th from 5 till 7, and that also is at the Village of Summers Municipal Building. And then the Highway C multi-use path in the Village of Pleasant Prairie, there's a public informational meeting on March 10th from 5 till 7 at the Village of Pleasant Prairie Municipal Building. And I will send out email all of you some specific information on those meetings. And then lastly, we're also proceeding on replacement of the fuel system here at the Kenosha County Center. And back tomorrow, we have a meeting with our engineering consultant. We're pretty much determined the design that we feel was most appropriate for this site here, and where we'll work most efficiently for both highways and all the other divisions that use that system. So at least as of now, we're still on schedule to get that completed by this fall. That's it.
Thank you, Gary. Any questions for Gary?
Yes.
Just a couple questions. We'll go from the most recent backward. We take a look at this fuel facility out here. If I recall, the anticipated idea would be to remove the underground storage, to have it all be above ground, and to have it be not dependent upon the heaving nature of the whatever we have, water table or soil conditions, whatever it is, right?
Yeah, and we probably are going to go back to the underground system. What we did was we investigated the issues with the above ground tanks and have found out that there's a big concern in cold weather about the diesel fuel. When it gets very cold, it tends to gel, and there basically is no system in place that gives us the confidence that that's not going to cause a problem for us in the winter. And we are the type of operation that I can't take that chance. I just cannot take the chance of us having fuel problems in the winter when we obviously have to be out on the road. So we went out into the yard, we drilled holes out in the yard, and we watched them, I don't know, it's been about 2 or 3 weeks now, to see if where the groundwater table, height the groundwater would establish itself at. And we think we found a location where the groundwater is not going to be an issue. So it's likely that we're probably going to go back with the underground tanks for that reason alone. So
primarily for the diesel situation.
Completely for the diesel situation.
And there's no way of having just, you know, some variety of thermal insulation or heater that would keep it from a gelling potential? That's not a rule.
There's systems where you can like heat wrap pipes and that, but I'm relying on the expertise of the consultants that we have. They've not given any of us the level of confidence where we think that we, you know, in the long term, it's not going to cause a problem in the future. It's just cold weather that has created this concern for us. And like I say, it's just not something we can take a chance on. So we think we're going to be okay. We've got more investigation to do on the soil situation, but I'm pretty comfortable right now where we're at.
The other point that pertains to that would be going forward, you know, we are a county on the move. It's just going to get nothing but bigger. There's been talks about expanding the sheriff's presence out here, and at some point in time it would not be too far out of the thought process to see where that's going to happen. If we had to have an additional 15, 20%, 25% capacity for this fuel system, are we thinking forwards towards that time and not just looking at what we have right now in terms of being able to service additional vehicles and so forth? Kevin?
Yeah, particularly in the with the unleaded or the gasoline situation, we're building in a considerable amount of additional capacity. We're actually adding capacity in both the gas and the diesel. And we're adding additional pumps.
Okay.
And we are going to arrange the pumps so that they're more efficiently laid out, so we can get more vehicles in at any given time.
So both the storage and the delivery will be upgraded.
Correct.
I just wanted to back up and go on to the Highway S project. I was not able to pretend that I wish I had been able to go there. Are we then taking the lead, basically, for the design and execution of that expansion? Where is the state planned to this? Where are they at?
The state is a, they manage the federal funds for federal highways, so they are a review agency to make sure that we comply with all the federal requirements that are tag along with these type of projects, most of which tend to be reporting and environmental issues, and not so much associated with the design. As far as the design goes, there's minimal state and federal requirements. So we have the by far the most oversight over the items that have the most direct impact to the project.
So we're taking the lead, in other words.
Correct.
Okay. So as far as the build out, that would be something we could do internally, or we'd let it out as far as the contract goes. Is that the way?
The contract will be let out. That's one of the requirements. We're anticipating the construction in 2019. And we're hoping to get that done in one calendar year. We think we're probably going to have to phase some portions of that project, but the vast majority of the construction should be able to be accomplished in one construction season.
Good. That's my question. Thank you. Did you have a comment?
I was just going to add, to piggyback a little bit on what Gary said about the tank. We kind of all went into it thinking we're definitely going to be doing it above ground, but when we met with the consultant, in addition to what Gary said as far as the temperature-related issues with the above ground, there's other technologies that have been developed for underground storage stuff to improve, like, the design and anchorability and movement management kind of stuff. So there was kind of a combination of stuff that we learned in that process. And, yeah, when we basically talked about it, going forward, it looks like we're still going to do, like, some additional testing, as Gary indicated, too, soils-wise, just to make sure what we believe to be in that spot is actually what's there. But it looks like underground is going to be the best long-term solution for us.
Is there any plans to put a concrete containment around the steel tanks then?
There wouldn't be underground containment. The construction techniques for the tanks themselves now have some built-in, and I'm not going to say they're all double-walled because it depends on what materials used, if it's steel versus fiberglass or another composite, but there's leak detection systems that are a really integral part of that whole process to determine if anything's going on. So they're really, really well designed now, really safe from that standpoint, from a leak standpoint.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else for Gary?
Quick question. How I know you've told us, Gary, I just don't recall. How many years old is the current system? Roughly?
It's 20, going on 24.
Yeah, a lot has changed in 25 years.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of new technologies, materials, sensors, and whatnot, besides underground to look a lot better than above the ground. Thanks for digging in that, guys.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything else? Here again?
No.
All right. Thank you. Great.
Give the committee an update on the Brookside project. The project bids were received on the 21st as scheduled. There were a total of 16 trade bid packages that made up the whole enchilada. And although a number of those packages came in under estimate, overall the total results were about 7% over our original estimates. Bidder turnout was okay, but it wasn't great. We only had 4 of the 16 packages that had 3 or more bidders. We brainstormed as to why that was. We had a pretty decent turnout at the pre-bid meeting. Not a great one, but pretty decent. We felt we were going to get at least 3 bids on every bid package. We didn't get that. The only conclusion I can draw at this point is that for this size project, which isn't like a mega project, but it's not something a mom and pop outfit could handle either, it's a fairly decent size project in that middle zone. And the number of contractors for some of the trades just aren't, they have not come back from where they were prior to the recession. I learned in this process, we no longer have a local paint shop in Kenosha. Ruffalo Painting and Decorating was the last one that existed. We don't even have local painters anymore. There's smaller ones, plenty of mom and pop outfits, but again, those that can kind of bid at this level project, there really isn't. We got a decent number for the big trades package, the HVAC, the site work, plumbing and electrical were decent. I think we got 3 for all of those packages, but a lot of the other trades packages were the drywall and framing. Big package. So it's basically all the pre-engineered trusses, and actually we're going to have modular walls that are brought in too. So very little of that will be constructed on site. There's only two companies left regionally that do that stuff. There was, I believe, four or five when we did the safety building project. So some of that stuff's impacted. So we didn't end up in as great a place as I was hoping, but we're in the value engineering phase. Since the 21st, we've been meeting weekly with the project team, the architects, and Kamozi Construction. And of that 7%, we got it whittled down to about 2%. And I'm confident in the next week or so we should have it down so we're below what our target is. We're able to do it without really hitting any of the core parts of the project. Some of the stuff, just to give the committee an idea, is there are some spray-on insulations that are marginally better than conventional insulations in terms of, again, it's technology that's improved. We had spec'd some of those things out. Given where that technology's at, the premium price for it, we pulled a lot of that stuff out. So we're going with conventional insulation where we had spec'd out some higher tech kind of products. So those are some of the things we've kind of pulled out. We're looking at reducing the amount of underground plumbing from a stormwater management standpoint, doing more of it with above ground where we can and still meet city requirements. So it's a lot of the stuff. Oh, one of the vapor barriers, a vapor barrier that we had spec'd, is a really good, a high-end vapor barrier that probably brought a little bit more to the table, but compared to conventional, and the cost differential associated with it, and installation associated with it, we're going to pull those kinds of things out. So a lot of the stuff that won't materially affect the end product from a function standpoint, or even an aesthetic standpoint, those are the kinds of things that we're drilling into to get the price down. So we're working on it. We're close. We're not quite there, but I think in the next week or so, by the next committee meeting, well, I should hopefully have a pretty good report that everything's on track and we're able to keep moving forward. Schedule-wise, we're still planning on the thing starting first week in April, weather depending. We've got some minor issues we've got to work out with the city yet for the conditional use permit, but nothing that seems insurmountable at this point. So that's pretty much where that one's at. The other item I've got is on the pretrial building. I promised the committee that I'd give them the full report. We had gotten it in early January. After we had the engineers come back, and Mike and I met with them in December and did a kind of a closer examination on some of the original cracks that we were concerned about. The bottom line is we're all very comfortable. The building is totally structurally sound. None of those large cracks have anything to do with structural issues. It appears that the big one, the one that was most concerning to me, was the fact that the engineer was able to unravel that there was supposed to be a control joint put in there in the original construction that wasn't put in there. So what happens when you don't put the control joint in? It will create its own control joint, and that's basically what we saw in the large crack. There was a number of other issues that we had them look at. They did a complete fly around of the building. All of the superficial cracks in the precast panels don't appear to be anything to be concerned about. That said, there were some things that were identified. There was a plan to remediate the actual crack itself with just an epoxy filling, which I think, if it didn't happen today, it's probably tomorrow going to happen. We're going to do some landscaping outside. We did some temporary to create a different topography, a grade from the building to eliminate some of the drainage issues there. There were some insulation issues that we found that there were certain offices that have been cold since day one, and especially when the crack started, and it was in those offices right above where the crack in the basement was. Everybody attributed to the crack being the issue that was causing the coldness in the wintertime there. There was actually some insulation that was never installed in a couple areas on the walls next to that building, or next to that office. So that's going to be taken care of. Minor stuff, it should be about $5,000 or less to deal with that. The one thing that we did, and we kind of knew this already, but they, obviously as they were flying a building around, they were able to take, and the pictures show it, the precast panels, the caulk ceiling in between there, it's at the end of its useful life, 20 plus years, or 20-ish years, I should say, in this case. So we had planned on, that was going to be one of our things we were going to be looking at. we're hoping we're going to put together specs and an estimate and find out if with the money we had left, I recommended we put $75,000 in as a placeholder when we developed the budget because we didn't know if there was going to be a structural issue or not. Thankfully, there wasn't. We may be able to use that money if it's adequate to do all of the joint sealing like we did on this building actually about 4 years ago, a similar process. So we'll see. So there might be more to follow on that. But good news is no structural issues, nothing major that needs fixing, just PM type stuff. That's pretty much it from that standpoint. Last thing, just a department report. Continuing orientation of Matt and with John and Clement with Gary. Clement has been really getting to know everybody in the entire highway department. He spent a lot of time with the guys down in the shop, the first line supervision and the guys in the shop so that we can maybe open up the lines of communication more effectively and just getting him out in the field with the guys. I feel that both Matt and Clement are fitting in really well, and the whole transition kind of development process is happening really, really smoothly. Gary can maybe speak to that as well, but that's my perception is that stuff is really, this was really a good thing we did by not waiting until Gary hung up his hat officially or John hung up his hat, and that we're doing this, should be a very smooth transition.
It even got a laurel in the Kenosha News.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Not a dart.
Not a dart. So I like to avoid the darts. That's pretty much it overall from the department standpoint.
Yes?
Just going back to the photos you provided for us, Ray, 405 and 406, the typical efflorescence. I've dealt with this and probably many homeowners have as well. Typically masonry where moisture is migrating from one area to another will carry chemical salts along with it. I've seen this commonly in common brick above and below grade type situations. I've not seen it in these precast panels. Is this indicative of moisture trying to work its way out from the inside? Is it more than just meets the eye? Can you comment?
It, from what I understood, because like you say, you can see this, typically you see it with concrete that's poured or block that's been installed when it's colder out, and they add either calcium chloride or other chloride type products to the masonry to slow the curing time. In a precast product, you don't expect to see a lot of that, but that is in fact what's coming out of here. Those are the salts leaching out, various salts and components that were a part of this mixture. The engineer indicated that the cracks that are there, the superficial cracks that are happening on the outside, he'd be concerned if there was more than just minerals leaching out. If there's any rust that forms, that means that the crack has penetrated to a point where it's affecting the rebar or whatever structural steel's been embedded into it, and that's an issue. And we didn't have any of that on the building, anywhere that they flew. So to answer your question, I guess, I'm not sure why this precast has this level of minerals leaching out of it. It had to have been whatever process they had wherever these were manufactured, and I can't remember the name of the place, but it is the same place that made the stuff that's on the O'Donnell parking garage in Milwaukee, that much I remember.
That reassures us, that's
right. Yeah. Well, that's why we had these guys do the analysis on this. These were the same forensic engineers that did the analysis for Habish and Habish or whoever it was, I can't remember the law firm name, that handled the situation up there. So I figured these guys are going to pick this apart. They're going to pick it apart as good as anybody because they're experienced with this specific manufacturer of precast. And they said, we're good to go.
So it's not indicative of a larger problem, is the bottom line is what you're saying?
Nope, that's the bottom line. Yeah.
That's my comment, my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Bill. Anything else?
Just one question, Ray. You'd mentioned if we saw some rusting, it might be indicative. But you said we didn't see any. But there's a photo in here of some rusting. So
yeah, that I think
just clarity
by the
dumpster, the trash can.
By the trash can, is that what you're looking
at? Let's see
at?
Here, number 13.
13. Yeah, they did take a picture of that minor rust staining. That specific one, to be honest with you, Mr. Supervisor Skolitsky, I can't explain. I just know that when we talked about the rust factor, they took a picture of that one, but they didn't indicate in
their
report.
It's minor, like you said, and it's the only one there. I just wanted to make sure it wasn't contrary to what they said. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Can't answer that one.
You can get rust in concrete even if there's no rebar. Certain stones will give you rust. Right. I've had, working with a lot of outdoor stone. You'll get it. Sometimes. Not a lot.
Is it a lot of iron?
Yeah.
Is that your rust?
Canada Dumphy.
Canada Dumphy, thank you. That's the one, yes.
Anything else?
Motion to adjourn.
All those in favor, the governor?
Aye.
Many?
Aye.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, gentlemen.